Your silence is commanding.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to welcome all of you today, but especially students from Green Lake High School. Would the students please stand? Good, you may be seated. The students are here with our Court with Class program. This is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students from all over the state are invited to attend an oral argument, and if the students accept that invitation, they're sent copies of the briefs in the case in which they will attend the oral argument, and they sometimes do extra activities connected with this case. At noon, these students met with other students from other high schools, namely Fall River High School, Lincoln High School, and Richland Center High School. And the students met with a justice of this court, and they discussed the procedures of the court in deciding cases. They did not discuss the substance of the cases. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. He was the justice who the students met with today. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Anne Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. With these introductions made, I'll call our third case for today, 04AP2481CR, State v. Mark D. Jensen. Arguing on behalf of the state will be Assistant Attorney General Marguerite Moeller. She will argue for 25 minutes. Then Attorney Craig Albee will argue for 25 minutes on behalf of the defendant, Mark Jensen. And then, because we have a petition and a cross-petition in this case, Ms. Moeller will argue for 5 minutes more, and then Mr. Albee in rebuttal for 5 minutes. Ms. Moeller.
Thank you, Your Honor. This matter is here on bypass of the Court of Appeals to review a pretrial order entered in the Kenosha County Circuit Court, the Honorable Bruce Schrader presiding. The state has appealed that portion of the trial court's order, excluding from evidence at Mark Jensen's homicide trial a letter written by the alleged victim, Julie Jensen, the defendant's wife, and oral statements Julie made to a police detective within 2 weeks before she died. Jensen has cross-appealed from that portion of the order, admitting at trial oral statements Julie made to her son's teacher, Teresa DeFazio, and to her next-door neighbors, the Voights. The statements to Voights were made over a period of several weeks before Julie's death, while the statements to the school teacher were made on November 25th, 1998, just 8 days before Julie's death. The trial court found that Julie's letter and her oral statements in a voicemail to Officer Kosman were testimonial under the Supreme Court's then-recent decision of Crawford versus Washington, and therefore inadmissible against Jensen at his trial. The trial court rejected the state's invitation to apply the doctrine known as forfeiture by wrongdoing to determine as a preliminary matter whether Jensen had forfeited his right to confrontation by killing Julie. However, the trial court found that Julie's oral statements to Ms. DeFazio and the Voights were non-testimonial under Crawford and could be admitted at Jensen's trial. On appeal, the state is asking this court to uphold the trial court's ruling, admitting the oral statements of Julie to her neighbors and the teacher, and to reverse that portion of the trial court's ruling excluding the letter and the voicemail message. And with respect to any of Julie's statements that this court would deem testimonial, and that would include statements that Julie made in a person-to-person conversation with Officer Cosman on November 24, 1998, this court should find that even though the statements are testimonial, the state can admit them at trial if it can convince the trial court outside the jury's presence and by a preponderance of the evidence that Jensen rendered Julie unavailable for cross-examination by killing her. With regard to the first issue presented, whether any of Julie's statements qualify as testimonial under Crawford, the resolution of this issue may well depend on the outcome of two cases that are presently pending before the United States Supreme Court, Davis versus Washington and Hammond versus Indiana. Davis deals with whether statements made during a 911 call are testimonial, while Hammond involves the question of whether a victim's oral statements to a responding officer are testimonial. Until those cases are decided, however, the state submits this court needs to look at Crawford versus Washington as the main source for determining whether a given statement is testimonial.
What about looking at Manuel and Stewart and Hale, which are our cases?
I think those are obviously also sources to which the court has to look, and in Manuel, this court adopted for the time being all three formulations of the various definitions of testimonial that the United States Supreme Court had listed in Crawford but did not specifically adopt. So we do have to look at Manuel, and I think it's also fair to look at cases from other jurisdictions which have applied Crawford in a variety of settings. But I think it's absolutely critical to start with Crawford versus Washington itself, because even though this court has gone somewhat further than Crawford insofar as it has adopted all three definitions of testimonial, I think giving flesh to that third category, that third definition, depends in part on the historical analysis that was done in Crawford and on the court's comment in that case that all three of the definitions it set forth had some sort of a common nucleus. And I think that this court has to decide what is that common nucleus that makes statements falling under any of those three categories testimonial.
So what is the common nucleus?
I believe the common nucleus is that law enforcement or the government, the state, however you want to describe it, had some kind of a role in producing the statement at issue. I know that the Crawford Court does not specifically say that. None of the definitions specifically say that either.
If the government has a role, that makes it testimonial. Is that what your position is?
I'm saying that the government's production of the testimony or the statement is an absolute indispensable requirement. I'm not suggesting that every time a statement is created through the action of the government that it's necessarily testimonial, because we know from a number of cases that you can have a statement made unwittingly to a police informant, an agent of the government, and courts have uniformly held that those statements are not testimonial, because when the person making the statement thought that he was speaking, let's say, to a confederate in crime, but it was really an undercover police officer, he could not have understood himself to be bearing witness against anyone. He would not have understood that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. So there are some categories of statements that are made to a government agent, and sometimes even with the government agent helping to produce the statement by perhaps asking a question, that are still not testimonial. But it's the state's position that under Crawford, if you look at the actual categories of statements that the Crawford court decided were definitely testimonial, all of them require the involvement of the government in their production. You've got grand jury testimony, preliminary hearing testimony, former trial testimony.
Depositions.
That wasn't one of the specific areas in which the court actually held that a statement was testimonial. The four examples were the three types of testimony and police statements made during the course of police interrogation. And I think it's pretty clear that all of those categories require the government to play a role in actually producing the testimony.
Under that test, the statements to the neighbors and to the school person, if that was it, would never be testimonial. Is that right?
They would never be testimonial unless there was some evidence in the case that these private parties were actually functioning as a proxy of the government, because certainly in other constitutional areas, you could have, let's say, a Fourth Amendment search conducted by a private party. And normally, if a private party breaks into your house and steals evidence and turns it over to the police, you're not going to have any right to suppress it. But if you're able to show that that private party was acting at the behest of the police or the government, then you are going to be able to make a motion to suppress. So I think the same thing would be true here, that if you had a person, let's say a private investigator, but they were hired by the government to go out and conduct an interview, and it was a custodial interrogation, whatever, that could definitely be a testimonial statement, even though the person taking it was not per se a government actor.
Ms. Muller, if I could, I'm looking at page 8 of your brief.
My opening brief?
Your opening brief, the blue one. And you described the three categories that this court adopted in Manuel from Crawford, and you're citing from Crawford. And when I look at the second one, extrajudicial statements contained in formalized testimonial materials such as affidavits, depositions, prior testimony, or confessions. Affidavits and depositions don't assume government interaction there. As I understood Crawford, what they were trying to get at is what could be used at a trial, and that kind of goes to the third definition. And so I guess I want to focus my question, because there are two statements that you seek to overturn the Court of Appeals on, correct?
That's correct.
One of them involves the voicemail message for Officer Cussman, and whether or not that's non-testimonial. And I guess I've been trying to figure out which of the three formulations under Crawford that voicemail message would be testimonial under.
I don't think it would be testimonial under any of those, because the first one is very clearly limited to the functional equivalent of ex parte in court testimony, something taken by one side to a dispute without any cross-examination by the other. And here you've basically got Julie Jensen calling Officer Cosman totally unsolicited and leaving a very informal oral statement on his message machine, if you will. So I don't think it falls under there, and certainly it's not a formalized.
And as I understood the statement, she said she wanted to talk to him because she was scared her phone was being tapped.
That's correct. She said she didn't want to say too much because she was afraid her husband might be recording the conversation. That was the gist of what she said. And I know there's some unclearness in the record about whether there was one or two voicemail messages, because I think if you look at the preliminary hearing testimony of Officer Cosman, I think he testified to two, but then later on when the district attorney made a written offer of proof for the trial court to rule on, I think the focus was only on one of those two voicemails, and it was the one where she said, I don't want to say too much because I'm afraid my phone conversation might be recorded.
Smola, doesn't your limiting testimonial to where government has some kind of role in producing a statement narrow that third category? that 30 clear character says statements made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe the statement would be available for use at later trial. It doesn't say it has to be produced by the government.
I understand that, and I think it does narrow it, but I think, again, you have to look at what do these three categories have as a, quote, common nucleus, and I think you have to look at all of the statements in Crawford where the court went through a very painstaking historical analysis and indicated that the confrontation clause was a response to various abuses that were creeping into the, that came from a civil law mode of criminal procedure, especially with the use of ex parte examinations where you'd have a justice of the peace, a coroner, somebody who was employed by the government would hail somebody before that person or before a legislative body and then force them to answer questions. And throughout the Crawford decision, the court referred to things like inquisitorial practices, and they used the word ex parte quite a bit, and the particular risk that was involved whenever the government had a role in producing or generating evidence. And so I think that when you look at these three definitions, and I have to point out that the third definition that this court adopted in Manuel has not yet been adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think that there's definitely the possibility that after the court decides Hammond and Davis, that this court might want to or need to retrench from its position that that third definition is necessarily an accurate rendition of what the U.S. Supreme Court meant when it said testimonial, because that's a definition that was taken out of an amicus brief filed by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, and quite honestly, that association would be more likely to advocate for a broader reach for what is testimonial than perhaps the U.S. Supreme Court would.
Or the state,
definitely. We have a vested interest in narrowing that definition. And I think if you look at the, I believe it's the second definition that came from the concurring opinion in White versus Illinois, which was written by, I believe, Justice Thomas and joined in by Justice Scalia, those two justices who are still on the Supreme Court, I don't think would go along with this more expansive, or possibly more expansive, third definition that the Crawford Court mentioned in the course of its analysis. But again, I'm just speculating because until the U.S. Supreme Court comes down with a decision, we really don't know what they're going to say. I mean, they might come down with a decision and say, all statements made to law enforcement are testimonial, end of story, which is the position, of course, that some courts have taken with respect to 911 calls. They might say you have to look at the circumstances.
You wouldn't take that position for 911 calls, 911 calls.
No, I would not. I would not take the position that those are testimonial. And I think the majority view is that statements made in 911 calls, generally speaking, are not testimonial. Now, again, there's three different camps on this. So what this really illustrates is that there's a whole lot of uncertainty about what is or is not testimonial. But I think if you're looking solely at Crawford, or if you look at the result in Manuel, not necessarily this court's adoption of the third category, but the statement there was a statement the declarant made to his girlfriend, and the result there was that that statement was not testimonial. But, of course, that was only one of many factors this court considered. More recently, our Court of Appeals in State versus Hemphill, and that's a case that was cited in my final brief, the Court of Appeals found that a statement made spontaneously to a police officer, and the declarant knew it was a police officer, was nevertheless not testimonial under Crawford for some of the same reasons I'm arguing here today. It was not instigated by or solicited by the police. The police were called to the scene of a disturbance, and when they got there, a woman by the name of Fields pointed to a man or men and said, "That's him, that's the one with the gun." It was totally spontaneous. The statement was certainly made to the police, and it was accusatory. It was saying, "That's the person you came to the scene to look for," but the Wisconsin Court of Appeals found that it was not a testimonial statement. And I think, obviously, if you use the test that we're asking for in terms of saying there has to be some sort of government involvement in the production of the statement, it goes without saying that none of the statements at issue here, either the ones that are subject of the state's appeal or the ones that are subject to Jensen's cross appeal, would qualify as being testimonial statements. And just briefly, I'd like to touch on the cross appeal, because that involves statements that were not even made to law enforcement.
Counselor, before you do that, I wonder, is it important for us to consider that the statements that were excluded by the earlier court decisions were made before the commission of a crime rather than after the commission of the crime or during the commission of a crime?
I think it's an important factor, because if you're looking at that third definition that this court adopted in Manuel, if there's not been a completed crime at the time a person is making a statement, what are the objective circumstances that would cause the person to believe it's going to be used at a later trial? At that time, no trial is anticipated. And I think you have to look at the facts that are actually existing at the time the statement's made. So the fact that there is no crime that has yet been committed is a factor that would militate against finding that the person thought he or she was being a witness or bearing testimony when the statement was made.
She thinks she's going to be killed.
That was the thing. She kept going back and forth. On the one hand, she'd say, "I'm afraid my husband is trying to poison me." But then when people would try to help her, she'd say, "No, I think I'm just overreacting. I pray to God this isn't going to happen." And I
think it does happen. She's got a written statement that she gives to, I think this one was the neighbor.
Right. She
says, "Give it to the cops. Should I die? Or should something happen to me?" All right. So here's my question. Assuming, for sake of argument, that your definition of testimonial is not accepted, that is, only to the police, and on questioning, I'm overstating maybe your statement, but close enough for us at the moment. Assuming that's not accepted, how would you interpret the third paragraph, the third exception? Would you interpret it as subjective of the declarant, subjective intent of the declarant, objective view of what the declarant is doing, or the listener? I mean, those are your three choices, I think, right, from the cases.
The cases definitely are all over the board on this, and I don't think it's just from the perspective of the listener, because you have to look at what the person thought they were doing when they made the statement, because otherwise you'd have the situation of the example I gave earlier, somebody who's making a statement to who a person they think is a confederate in crime, and it's really an undercover officer, and we know that that's not testimonial. So the objective person who knows all the facts said, well, of course, they're going to put this statement into evidence at trial. But this person subjectively believes that this person is a fellow drug dealer, not a cop. And so I think in that sense, the subjective belief, you know, does come in, even though the test itself refers to an objective witness. And I think this also poses a very perplexing question when you talk about young children. I think it's very possible that you could have a child who is so young that that child cannot give a testimonial statement. There's no such thing as a testimonial statement from perhaps a two-year-old. They can talk and they can relate things, but they don't fit into any of those categories.
And, before we, and I know your light's on.
And I haven't talked about my second issue.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. I wanted to talk about just for a moment the forfeiture by wrongdoing, because assuming the statement that the Chief Justice talked about is testimonial, your argument is that it should come in by forfeiture by wrongdoing, because there of the at least your allegation that he forfeited the right because of his so allegedly killing his wife. Now, that is a very narrow. What are the parameters of that?
Well, the state is actually advocating for a broad interpretation of this equitable doctrine. And the doctrine has its roots in equity, and the principle for it is that a person should not be able to complain about a situation that he or she has created. A person should not be able to benefit by his or her wrongdoing. The principle was acknowledged by the U.S. Supreme Court in Reynolds, and then it really lay dormant for quite a few years, and I recognize that the federal rule that has codified the principle, at least for purposes of the hearsay rule, has an intent element, and the intent is that the wrongdoing occurred for the purpose of preventing the declarant from testifying. And Mr. Albee, on behalf of Mr. Jensen, is arguing that you have to have that intent element. And the state is saying no, because to effectuate the equitable principle behind the rule, you have to apply it in a situation like this. How can you complain that you don't have the right to confront somebody because they're unavailable when you made that person unavailable? I think the logic of the proposition is unassailable. And since Crawford admittedly...
The logic of that proposition also assumes that the person, in fact, killed the deceased when, in fact, that's what the person is on trial for?
I think that you're talking about the same determination that's made by two separate fact finders for different purposes. And you've got the trial court, and the federal courts do this all the time. You have the trial court making a finding by a preponderance of the evidence that the defendant is responsible for the declarant being unavailable. And it doesn't have to be by murdering the person, obviously. It could be by threats or intimidation. But cases that have been decided after Crawford, and there have been at least four states whose cases are cited in my brief, I think it was Texas, Colorado, can't remember, Kansas perhaps, and the Sixth Circuit in United States versus Garcia Mesa have all held that it makes perfectly good sense to extend this principle even where the defendant is on trial for the same conduct that underlies the unavailability finding.
But in the federal court, they also tack on that intent element, and you're arguing that we not add that.
Well, the federal rule has the intent element, but that's a rule of evidence. And the court in Garcia Mesa said, well, we're talking about a constitutional right here. We're not talking about a rule of evidence, and we shouldn't be limited by what Congress has done. And I think that's the reason a lot of the cases that are cited in Mr. Albee's brief and that I've referenced have this intent element, because they're based on the federal rule. And there's state rules that are counterpart to the federal rule. They have the intent element. But one of the more recent cases out of an intermediate appellate court in Illinois, Nelcor, that's I cited in, I think, my final brief that just came down in November, the court went out of its way, even though the factual circumstances of that case, I see my...
Paragraph.
The court said that even though that case didn't involve a murder, that those are unique cases, and it adopted that broad version of forfeiture by wrongdoing for Illinois law, and it's consistent with the position we are advocating here.
If I might, Ms. Mullis, there's one point you haven't argued, and perhaps for a very good reason, but I have to confess I'm somewhat troubled by the possibility of having a person who's worried about being killed submitting evidence to various sources saying, hey, look, this is going on. You know, if anything happens, give this to the police, and how that should be handled. And I guess my question goes as to whether or not one of the things that perhaps we should look at is whether to explore more carefully the imminence requirement of dying declarations.
Thank you.
I assume by that question you'd extend it from imminent death to 5 weeks.
They would argue that we should look at that. That's what I'm inquiring about.
You'd be extending that time period.
I haven't really thought about whether that would be one way of dealing with that. The question of the language that's in the current statute, dying declarations, the person has to believe that he or she is under impending death. And under your example, it would just be death at, I don't exactly know how you would write that, because you could have a domestic violence situation where something has been going on for years, a husband and wife involved in an abusive relationship, and statements might go back years, and then he eventually...
You could have the facts of this case where, you know, this is happening, I'm not sure what's going on, here's a letter, if anything happens to me, give this to the police.
Within a week's period.
And I guess it still wouldn't answer the question that's posed about whether those statements are testimonial, though, so you'd still have to...
Dying declarations, as I understand it, are an exception.
Well, I don't think the Crawford Court actually said 100%. They said if it has to be accepted on a historical basis, it would be sui generis. So I think that the jury is still out on that one as well. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Murray, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Albee, representing Mark D. Jensen.
May it please the Court, my name is Craig Albee. I represent Mark Jensen. The purpose of the Confrontation Clause is to guarantee the defendant's right to confront his accusers. I think it's important that we don't lose sight of that overarching purpose of the Confrontation Clause in devising various formulations, factors to consider in deciding whether statements are testimonial. The founders of our country wanted to establish the Sixth Amendment so that accusatory testimony would not be given behind closed doors by affidavit, by letter, but in open court, under oath, in the presence of the accused, and subject to cross-examination. And I think whenever we're considering whether a statement is testimonial, we must bear in mind that overarching purpose. The state proposes that government involvement in the production of a statement is required for a statement to be testimonial. I believe that following that principle would do violence to what the founders of our country intended in establishing the Confrontation Clause. And let me start by addressing the particular facts we have here, which is a letter which is sent unsolicited by Mrs. Jensen to a police officer that is accusing her husband of engaging in suspicious behaviors, that she believes that she may be in some jeopardy and that he would be the first suspect if something happens to her. Certainly this letter is accusatory. I believe that the rule established by the Sixth Circuit is appropriate, which is that statements that are knowingly made to authorities that are accusatory are testimonial, basically as a matter of law. I suppose there could be some exceptions to that principle, but frankly, I can't think of any example that I think would fall as an exception. That is a proposal of Professor Friedman, and that was adapted by the Sixth Circuit in both Arnold and the earlier case. It's also consistent with what the Tenth Circuit did in Summers, although I don't believe that they expressly adopted that principle.
I understand, Professor Friedman, I haven't read the original article, but I've read about it, that his position is sort of a broad view of what's testimonial. That is, many things might be labeled as testimonial, but then he has a very broad view of the doctrine that would let it in anyway.
I wouldn't characterize it necessarily as a broad view. It's certainly broader than the views of, say, Justice Justice Thomas, who apparently would greatly restrict the definition of testimonial to only to police-generated statements. But I think it's more consistent with other scholars. And in fact, the amicus brief he filed in Crawford, the amicus brief was filed on behalf of a number of law professors, including Professor Friedman, and they proposed basically the same definition as the National Association of Criminal Defense.
No, you would not limit it to. Does he limit it to statements to authorities?
No, certainly not.
And you would not either.
I would not either, as I'm arguing that the statements to the voits, I think, would be
are testimonial, contrary to the trial court.
Correct. And I think the way it's phrased in the law professor's amicus brief in Crawford is whether the declarant would have reasonably anticipated the statement's use in the investigation or prosecution.
That's sort of an objective standard of that particular declarant.
Correct.
Would a declarant similarly situated reasonably believe?
Yeah,
is that your view?
It is. It is. If the court were to adopt the principle that a statement must be generated by government involvement, well, first of all, I think that would be directly contrary to what this court already determined in Manuel.
Mr. Albee, before you go to that, you were going to talk about both of these statements, the letter, and you never got to the second one, the voicemail. I guess my question is with respect to the voicemail message, using any of the criteria that were adopted in Manuel, or the three criteria identified in Crawford, how is the voicemail testimonial under any of those definitions?
I believe that any objective witness making the kind of accusation that she made in the voicemail to a police officer would reasonably anticipate its use at trial. And part of the problem may be in ascertaining exactly what she said in the voicemail. As I indicated in footnote 7 of my brief, what Officer Cosman testified to at the preliminary hearing was something along the lines, I'm having a little problem with Mark. I think he's trying to kill me. And I think that's the kind of accusation, when knowingly made to a police officer, anyone would reasonably believe could be used at a future trial.
So let me just ask, because I want to follow up, since we don't have a lot of time, on this forfeiture by wrongdoing. And just we talked about the parameters your opposing counsel did. Let's say that let's just change the facts, but someone's on the phone with the police, so-and-so is going to kill me, and then there's a shot. And what about that statement? What would you think certainly would be testimonial?
Then
they come over and they find someone with a gun in their hand. All right, I'll just make it easier.
I think that is a testimonial statement, although I think there is something to be said about the notion of separating 911 calls into an immediate portion that's asking for help, and what almost invariably happens, which is some follow-up questions about the identity of the perpetrator, or you know, describing what's happened. And there are a number of courts, and I think it's the situation in Davis, which is one of the State v. Davis, which is the Washington case that's been accepted for review by the United States Supreme Court. I believe there they engaged in that sort of separation. But if not there, it's happened in several other cases. And I think there may be something to be said for that, is that an initial cry for help may not be testimonial, but then later narrative about the circumstances would be testimonial.
So your position then, and I just want to touch base on this forfeiture by wrongdoing, in this case would be, obviously, I shouldn't ask you, what is your position on forfeiture by wrongdoing?
The principle proposed by the state is much too broad, in my estimation. The principle the state proposes, and which has frankly been adopted in several states now, is entirely the creation of 2004. It really, this broad forfeiture by wrongdoing exception really did not exist prior to Crawford. I believe it's a policy exception that's been adopted by some courts to reduce the sting of Crawford because the courts don't like the results. And I think Crawford forbids that by saying we're not going to have case-by-case determinations. That's one reason why they abandoned the Roberts test, and that there will be no open-ended exceptions to the Confrontation Clause. As of the founding, as I think is demonstrated in the brief, the historical analysis demonstrates that as of the time of the founding, and indeed until the 1970s, forfeiture by wrongdoing really only went to the unavailability requirement, and that statements would only be introduced if they had been previously subject to cross-examination. In the 1970s and continuing until 2004, it was broadened if the actor acted with the purpose really to obstruct justice, to engage in witness tampering in some fashion. And there are a number of cases adopting that principle.
So that would be like before trial, giving a ticket to somebody to go to Jamaica that was going to testify?
That may be one circumstance. I think what prompted the
full intent we talked.
What prompted the rule, I think, were the, you know, essentially mob cases where witnesses disappeared on the eve of trial, sometimes with a bullet or sometimes for other reasons. And I think that bears some resemblance to the forfeiture by wrongdoing principles adopted in United States Supreme Court cases like Illinois v. Allen and the Taylor case in the 70s, where the court said you can forfeit your right to be present in a courtroom by engaging in outlandish or obstructive behavior. You can give up your right to be present if you absent yourself after a trial has started. But those are the kinds of forfeiture that go to the integrity of the trial and are intentionally acted upon to undermine justice in the case. Perhaps for a separate reason, there's a basis for adopting a middle ground there. But I believe that Crawford forbids an open-ended exception. And this is entirely a creation of 2004 to say we really kind of want to get around Crawford and let's say if somebody's murdered somebody, that we can introduce the statements.
What advice would you give to a person who thought they were going to be murdered by a particular individual and didn't want that individual to get away with it? Is the victim simply not going to be able to be vindicated?
Well, I certainly understand the pull of the state's argument here. I mean, you can come up with situations where you say you're silencing the domestic violence victim, you're letting the defendant profit from wrongdoing. But the problem is we do have the presumption of innocence, and how do we make that determination? The way we do it in this country is beyond a reasonable doubt finding of guilt by a jury when all the evidence is presented. And we're going to find ourselves in some situations where we have innocent people wrongfully convicted because statements are introduced without cross-examination. I think the rule of confrontation always has had instances where the state has lost the benefit of evidence because we want to protect defendants' rights. Starting with King v. Payne in the late 17th century, when England decided that the prior statements of a dead witness could not be used, I mean, that certainly hurts their ability to prove their case through no apparent fault of the government. Modern-day cases, including, for instance, the United States v. Shepard, where the issue there, it's a 1934 United States Supreme Court case, and the issue there was whether the decedent's statement about her husband saying, "Dr. Shepard has poisoned me," whether that was admissible as a dying declaration. And it was found not to be a dying declaration in that case because I believe because she wasn't under the belief of impending death. But nonetheless, there was no consideration by the court of devising some other rule to admit that kind of statement as to her belief that it was her husband who had poisoned her. And so I believe this to be the longstanding rule. What also is, I think, difficult about this is if the defendant's guilt is rather obvious. I mean, let's say there was a confession by the defendant after the fact and a number of corroborating circumstances. Then it may be more easily argued that forfeiture is appropriate and that the decedent's statements should be introduced. But on the other hand, probably isn't necessary in those cases. It's the cases such as this one where the evidence suffers from a number of weaknesses, and we want to decide whether to introduce these statements depending on the state proposes a preponderance. And I certainly believe we should use clear and convincing evidence or something much stronger if forfeiture were ever to be adopted.
Well, what's the matter with these statements? Man, when I read it, read fact situations in the state's brief and in your brief, I thought, I certainly want those in. This is a truth-seeking procedure. If somebody murders somebody, you want them behind bars. What is it about these statements that make them of dubious value in a prosecution?
There are a number of concerns that I have with the admission of these statements. First of all, I think they can be very inflammatory. We've heard in pretrial hearings in this case, and I'd sort of expect to hear again the sort of voice from the grave predicting death and those kind of things.
That's persuasive, and then somebody dies, you figure, well, she knew something. We better find out.
Well, this is sort of beyond the scope of this court's decision making at the moment. But I mean, we have argued, and I think correctly so, regarding the relevance of statements making predictions. We don't allow living witnesses to testify concerning predictions of the future, and that may be another problem. I also can point to, and this is even in the criminal complaint itself. Mrs. Jensen supposedly tells the teacher that when I walk in the room, Mark Jensen covers up the computer and won't let me see, or he turns it off. She tells the neighbor he leaves things on the computer for me to observe and to look at. She tells the neighbor the teacher, he's controlling and he won't let me look for a job. She tells the neighbor, I want to find a job, Mark won't let me. And there are several other examples like that of these kind of inconsistencies. And, I mean, that's just in the people that she talked to giving those kind of different versions. Those are exactly the kinds of things that are disclosed during cross-examination. And when you have a witness who's not subject to cross-examination and there's sympathy for a decedent, whether it's suicide or homicide, people feel bad that this living person has passed from the earth.
But you can show on cross-examination and having all these witnesses come in, and then you make the argument, you see, she was inconsistent, there's something the matter with her. And then you have the psychiatric testimony that says she's really planning to commit suicide and she's going to get the last word in this and accuse him of killing her. So she's going to take him with her.
Well, I would agree that, I mean, we can do all those things, but perhaps what I should have said at the outset of this conversation we're having is we're starting to get back into Roberts territory, and the Crawford court says, you know, this, we have a way of doing this in our country, and it's cross-examination or nothing.
Maybe it's the way you look at Crawford. If you look at it as protecting confrontation, which is a Scalia theme, you know, eyeball to eyeball, cross-examination in the courtroom, eyeball to eyeball. If you look at that as the key factor in Crawford, therefore things, evidence that don't fit that testimonial can't be introduced. you look at that as the key factor of Crawford, then you may be right. If you look at Crawford as indicating that you want court-oriented or government-oriented matters to continue to be introduced, and that's a theme that the state finds in those three criteria, if you look at it that way, then the state wins. So what I don't know is, how should I look at Crawford?
Well, I do think that it's certainly broader than the state characterizes it, and that one thing about confrontation is that it's a trial protection. It's not a protection against police misconduct like the Fourth Amendment might be characterized. And so what we want is to assess reliability through a particular method at trial. There's nothing wrong with the police taking somebody into a room and having conversations with them and transcribing it or doing it under oath or whatever they want to do, so long as when you get to trial, the defendant has that opportunity to cross-examine.
In response to Justice Prosser, so she calls the police department, she sees an officer. What can they do to memorialize her testimony? Can they take a written affidavit sworn from her? Would that do it? Can they take a written affidavit and then also call in the husband and take an affidavit? Can they, if he's willing to do it, can they call him in and say, we're taking an affidavit and you have the right to cross-examination? I mean, what can she do? She says she's in fear of her life. She's sure she's going to, relatively sure she's going to get murdered. What can we do to protect that evidence and get it in? Then she's killed. And not by a drunk driver, but
this is the difficult question, and I'm not sure I have a satisfactory answer that would govern all cases. But I mean, certainly, if there's time after a phone call, and I mean, let's say it's a situation where somebody is wounded or hospitalized, I think, you know, it. Certainly one thing that could be attempted is what's suggested, which is taking deposition, having counsel present with the defendant for any cross-examination. I mean, that may be one
option. Does that sound realistic? I mean, we'll each give you our example, but that really, from legal and common sense and just realistically, is that something that ordinarily to get an attorney and have a deposition is something that's foreign to most people. So we're talking about something that is in the real world and would happen. And what I wanted to know is your answer to me was that you felt that the person on the phone describing what's happening as then it happened would be testimonial, if I
think
so. Realistically, there really isn't anything that you could think of. I'm talking about in the real world, other than taking depositions, that a person could do.
And how can you take a deposition when there's no pending case?
Well, I was. But
I haven't gotten that far.
Just legally,
right on the real world.
Yeah. And you know I suppose we can come up with real-world examples there. We could have false allegations and the defendant never has a chance to engage in the cross-examination that would demonstrate his innocence. You know, that's another horrible...
Isn't that your defense here, or a defense? That this is a false accusation?
Absolutely.
Mr. Albee, let me tell you what's bothering me about your argument. As I understand the Crawford requirements, the unavailability and the prior opportunity to cross-examine, if we take your argument to its nth degree, that means any time
in a criminal case, a witness dies, that witness's testimony cannot be introduced. And I just can't believe that that's what Crawford means. Tell me if I'm wrong.
I think as a general proposition, that is accurate. And I think that's been when Justice Scalia cites King v. Payne from the 17th century, that was the case then. The witness has passed away, even though that witness gave a statement to the coroner or whoever took it in that particular case. That statement was inadmissible, regardless of how reliable it was. That was part of the common law tradition, and that is what Justice Scalia, I believe in Crawford, the court in Crawford, proposes.
It's an original intent argument.
It is.
Isn't that how it's labeled in the literature? A discussion of Crawford, that it's an original intent, that you go back to the time of the drafting of the constitutional amendment and look and see how that doctrine of confrontation was at that time, and then apply it in modern times as best you can.
That's my understanding of the Crawford decision, and it's the basis for our forfeiture argument as well, is because at that time.
Yeah.
And your forfeiture argument has a scope that the demise has to occur in order to prevent the victim from testifying. That's what you're proposing as part of forfeiture doctrine?
I think that part of forfeiture could be adopted consistent with the Supreme Court's decisions in Allen and Taylor. That is, when there's an attempt to obstruct ongoing court proceedings, that would permit that forfeiture in that instance.
What's Friedman's theory on the doctrine of forfeiture?
It is, frankly, pretty much as the state would seek to apply it here. What is, I think, startling in its omission is any discussion as to the historical basis for forfeiture. It seems to me to be a policy determination, and it seems like a good idea given the results that his other proposals engender.
And while he seems to say, as I understand it, look, we're going to get rid of a lot of evidence by saying it's testimonial, right? And I'm big into labeling it testimonial. I mean, he's one of the fathers of the theory, bringing it back. Okay. So I really think as a matter of law and in theory, you ought to have broad testimonial. You ought to have testimonial. Then he says, hey, what's going to happen is the courts are going to get very uptight because a lot of evidence, before the state and contrary to the defendant, will not be introduced, which means you're going to get a lot less convictions. And in order not to destroy this theory about what's testimonial, what we have to do is open the back end, because otherwise the courts are going to open the front end of what's testimonial. So you have this great theory about what's testimonial and keep it broad. And then he says, yeah, but you know, the courts are going to, they're not going to let these guys go. They're going to convict. So in order not to ruin the first end and the theory, you can open up the back end and let it in.
I think in a sense it carries up a lot of the same problems as using reliability as an escape hatch.
It doesn't matter what theories you use, because you wind up with, you're going to let much more in, whether you do it at the front end, back end, or Ohio v. Roberts.
That can be true. I should point out there is one important difference in Professor Friedman's view versus the state's, which is wants, I think, a clear and convincing standard, certainly
yes.
Something much greater than preponderance.
Right. That's my understanding. And we're not bound by Professor Friedman, nor is the U.S. Supreme Court. Ms. Miller.
I think Justice Wilcox's example about the victim who is on the phone with the police and saying, I am going to be shot, I think he's going to kill me, and then the police or the dispatcher hears a gunshot, person dies, they come to the scene, and that statement, according to Mr. Albee, would be a testimonial statement at least as long as the caller identified who the person was that was going to shoot her. So in other words, just by happenstance, if the 911 caller says, help, my husband's got a gun, he's going to shoot me, according to Mr. Albee, that would be a testimonial statement. And if the person were then killed, the police could not, the state could not use that statement at a later prosecution, even though it would obviously have, you know, great facility for the truth-finding function. And I don't think
Dying declaration.
This is before death.
Right.
But it's before.
They never talk after death, at least as far as I'm concerned. So.
They didn't know.
Some of us do. But
right away.
I'm talking about others. But even if it is a dying declaration,
It might still be testimonial.
That's right. The confrontation in Crawford, confrontation,
the
evidentiary statute.
So I do think that it's, you know, fair to say that under the definition or the interpretation urged by the defense in this case, we would be losing a lot of those kinds of statements from evidence at a criminal trial. Going on to the doctrine of forfeiture by wrongdoing, I think even though when the United States Supreme Court in Reynolds said that it would use the doctrine, and in that case we were talking about a situation where there had been a former trial where Reynolds had been charged with bigamy, and for some reason there had to be a retrial, and they were going to use prior testimony. It's true that the prior testimony there had been subject to cross-examination. But I think what gets overlooked is that the U.S. Supreme Court in Reynolds cited Lord Morley's rule as a justification for adopting the rule of forfeiture by wrongdoing. And the holding in Lord Morley's case has been described, and I've got that on footnote 5 of our brief, as uncrossed depositions given to the coroner are admissible at trial if the prosecution can prove to the trier of fact satisfaction that the defendant procured the witness's absence. So the fact that the Reynolds Court was citing Lord Morley's case with approval, I think, belies the defense contention that the origin of the rule was only as a surrogate for unavailability, that it only applied when the prior testimony had been subject to cross-examination. That was not the case in Lord Morley's case. Insofar as the complaint is that adopting the state's broad version of the rule would eviscerate the presumption of innocence, I don't think that's accurate either, because all we're doing is allowing the jury to hear these statements as just one bit of evidence at a criminal trial. The jury still makes the ultimate determination of guilt or innocence. The jury still makes it beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury is not told that the trial court has already, outside of its presence, determined by a preponderance of the evidence that, in fact, the defendant has committed the act for which he is on trial. And insofar as Professor Friedman would go for the clear and convincing evidence, only he and the courts, I believe, in New York would adopt this greater standard. The preponderance of the evidence standard would be consistent with our own statute, 901.04(1), where preponderance of the evidence is the standard used for making preliminary determinations on the admissibility of evidence. It's consistent with State versus Frams, a decision of our Court of Appeals. And it's also consistent with what is done in the area of co-conspirator statements made in furtherance of a conspiracy. There, the trial court makes the determination of whether or not a conspiracy existed by only a preponderance of the evidence, and that, in turn, enables the prosecution, the government, to introduce statements that would otherwise be barred either on hearsay or confrontation grounds.
If the trial court should find by a preponderance of evidence that the defendant was the murderer, could that be used in a civil trial against the defendant?
I don't think that it could, because the civil would still have to, I'm not very familiar with civil cases, but I thought that the standard would be higher than that at a civil trial.
Not for wrongful death.
I guess I'd have to say that I really don't know the answer to that question without having done some more research on it. In conclusion, the court would ask, the state would ask this court to reverse that portion of the trial court's ruling excluding Julie Jensen's statements from evidence at Mr. Jensen's homicide trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Mr. Alvey.
Let me quickly address Justice Wilcox's example again, at least as restated by the state. Help, my husband's got a gun, he's going to shoot me. In that case where the narrative is so closely associated with the cry for help, you know, that becomes a difficult question. That potentially is one where that whole statement would come in because it's more the cry for help than the anticipated use at trial situation. I think it is likely a dying declaration, which is potentially a recognized exception in Crawford. It also is possibly a spontaneous declaration. The Crawford decision suggests at least the possibility that spontaneous declarations, those made immediately as something's occurring, may be a recognized exception. I think the other thing is if the witness is on the phone when she's shot, arguably it is for the purpose of silencing a witness. And so that may be yet another basis on which that would be admissible.
But arguably it also is testimonial under the third prong that we adopted in Manuel, that is, statements that were made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial. I mean, it's not as though the caller is saying, oh, I think this might be used at a later trial, but what is going on is the caller is asking for help in identifying the perpetrator of the imminent crime, which for purposes of assistance and investigation.
Obviously we don't have a 911 situation here, but it's the courts in other cases have occasionally held is the help part is not testimonial. And then as you get into the oftentimes there isn't something this urgent as described by Justice Wilcox, but there may be questions of how long have you known him? When did he get there? A number of other questions in a narrative, and those do become testimonial, I think. I mean, this is, at what point the shift takes place, that's a difficult question, probably subject of complete briefing in a case where the issue is presented. I think Justice Prosser, there may be instances, a number of instances in the kind of situation where you described, where if the person's worried about something in the future and takes some action with police and it becomes known to the potential perpetrator, if you will, that there's these complaints or that the person may be a witness, well, then maybe it falls into that middle ground, the way the federal courts have described the forfeiture by wrongdoing for many years. But not this expansive forfeiture rule that the state proposes here, which I think is just completely out of step with the what the rule of forfeiture by wrongdoing was at the time of the founding.
Could I follow up? It seems to me, now correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me forfeiture by wrongdoing, according to your definition, is a situation in which a person has been charged with something, and following that charge, the defendant takes some action to to get a witness out of the picture, whether it's murder or flying them to Jamaica. There have to be a lot of situations, though, where future litigation is contemplated. For example, a man and wife, the wife is threatening divorce. She's likely to take a great deal of the man's property. Or the wife has learned that the man is sexually abusing the children and is about to report that and seek a divorce. Under those circumstances, the man might have an incredible motive to get her out of the picture, to avoid her future testimony. Doesn't that come under forfeiture by wrongdoing, too?
Some of the cases prior to Crawford, I think, adopted something along the lines of what you propose, in that informant cases where it was learned the informant was cooperating and had intentions of being a witness at that trial, but the case had not yet been charged, where courts found forfeiture by wrongdoing in those instances, which I think could be similar to what you are suggesting here. And again, I guess it would really depend on the particular facts and the ability to prove that the intent was to get rid of the person as a witness. But in that case, yes, perhaps that would be forfeiture by wrongdoing.
At least you don't want it if it's a murder charge against that witness.
Pardon?
If the charge is A murdered B, you don't want this exception to apply in that instance where the murder is for another reason.
I guess it would apply if that witness is going to be the witness in the drug case or something, but yeah.
Or against him in an attempted murder case.
Could be.
If you got that far. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Albee. Thank you, Ms. Moeller, for your arguments today in issue that we have only started to face as a result of the Crawford case. That concludes our argument in 04AP2481CR, State versus Jensen, and the court is in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. We are in recess.